from PRI, Public Radio International.
A charity performance was staged in town. I went into the governor's box, having been invited in the interval, and there was Anne Luganovich, seated by the governor's wife. Again, I was struck by that same irresistible, vibrant beauty, by that charming, friendly expression in her eyes. And again, I sensed an intimacy shared.
You're listening to Joe Morton reading from Anton Chekhov's story Concerning Love. You'll be hearing the story later on today's edition of Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. This is a program devoted to two master storytellers, Eudora Welty and Anton Chekhov. We'll begin with Welty's mysterious tale of a lady in a garden, a curtain of green. Eudora Welty lived from 1909 until 2001 in Jackson, Mississippi. In 1970, she was awarded the Edward McDowell Medal, one of the reasons her story was included in our program celebrating the 100th anniversary of the McDowell Writers' Colony, a program presented by the Westport Arts Center at the Westport Country Playhouse in Connecticut. Why do I call this story mysterious? Well, what is it, do you think, that the lady is about to do when suddenly she stops herself? And what has happened to her at the very end? Listen closely. Eudora Welty's A Curtain of Green. The reader is the actress Frances Sternhagen.
Every day one summer in Larkin's Hill, it rained a little. The rain was a regular thing and would come about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. One day, almost as late as 5 o'clock, the sun was still shining. It seemed almost to spin in a tiny groove in the polished sky, and down below, in the trees along the street and in the rows of flower gardens in the town, every leaf reflected the sun from a hardness like a mirror surface. Nearly all the women sat in the windows of their houses, fanning and sighing, waiting for the rain. Mrs. Larkin's garden was a large, densely grown plot, running downhill behind the small white house where she lived alone now, since the death of her husband. The sun and the rain that beat down so heavily that summer had not kept her from working there daily. Now the intense light, like a tweezers, picked out her clumsy, small figure in its old pair of men's overalls rolled up at the sleeves and trousers, separated it from the thick leaves and made it look strange and yellow as she worked with a hoe, overvigorous, disreputable, and heedless. Within its border of hedge, high like a wall, and visible only from the upstairs windows of the neighbors, this slanting, tangled garden, more and more overabundant and confusing, must have become so familiar to Mrs. Larkin that quite possibly by now she was unable to conceive of any other place. Since the accident in which her husband was killed, she had never once been seen anywhere else. Every morning she might be observed walking slowly, almost timidly, out of the White House, wearing a pair of untidy overalls, often with her hair streaming and tangled where she had neglected to comb it. She would wander about for a little while at first, uncertainly, deep among the plants and wet with their dew, and yet not quite putting out her hand to touch anything. And then a sort of sturdiness would possess her, stabilize her. She would stand still for a moment, as if a blindfold were being removed, and then she would kneel in the flowers and begin to work. She worked without stopping, almost invisibly, submerged all day among the thick, irregular, sloping beds of plants. The servant would call her at dinner time, and she would obey, but it was not until it was completely dark that she would truthfully give up her labor, and with a drooping, submissive walk, appear at the house, slowly opening the small, low door at the back. Even the rain would bring only a pause to her. She would move to the shelter of the pear tree, which hung in mid-April heavily, almost to the ground in brilliant full leaf in the center of the garden. It might seem that the extreme fertility of her garden formed at once a preoccupation and a challenge to Mrs. Larkin. Only by ceaseless activity could she cope with the rich blackness of this soil. Only by cutting, separating, thinning, and tying back in the clumps of flowers and bushes and vines could she have kept them from overreaching their boundaries and multiplying out of all reason. The daily summer rains could only increase her vigilance and her already excessive energy. And yet, Mrs. Larkin rarely cut, separated, tied back. To a certain extent, she seemed not to seek for order, but to allow an overflowering, as if she consciously ventured forever a little farther, a little deeper, into her life in her garden. She planted every kind of flower that she could find or order from a catalog, planted thickly and hastily without stopping to think, without any regard for the ideas that her neighbors might elect in their club as to what constituted an appropriate vista, or an effect of restfulness, or even harmony of color. Just to what end Mrs. Larkin worked so strenuously in her garden, her neighbors could not see. She certainly never sent a single one of her fine flowers to any of them. They might get sick and die, and she would never send a flower. And if she thought of beauty at all, they regarded her stained overalls, now almost of a color with the leaves. She certainly did not strive for it in her garden. It was impossible to enjoy looking at such a place. To the neighbors gazing down from their upstairs windows, it had the appearance of a sort of jungle, in which the slight, heedless form of its owner daily lost itself. At first, after the death of Mr. Larkin, for whose father, after all, the town had been named, they had called upon the widow with decent frequency. But she had not appreciated it, they said to one another. Now, occasionally, they looked down from their bedroom windows as they brushed studiously at their hair in the morning. They found her place in the garden as they might have run their fingers toward a city on a map of a foreign country, located her from their distance almost in curiosity, and then forgot her. Early that morning, they had heard whistling in the Larkin garden. They had recognized Jamie's tune and had seen him kneeling in the flowers at Mrs. Larkin's side. He was only the colored boy who worked in the neighborhood by the day. Even Jamie, it was said, Mrs. Larkin would tolerate only now and then. Throughout the afternoon, she had raised her head at intervals to see how fast he was getting along in his transplanting. She had to make him finish before it began to rain. She was busy with the hoe, clearing one of the last patches of uncultivated ground for some new shrubs. She bent under the sunlight, chopping in blunt, rapid, tireless strokes. Once she raised her head far back to stare at the flashing sky. Her eyes were dull and puckered, as if from long impatience or bewilderment. Her mouth was a sharp line. People said she never spoke. But memory tightened about her easily. Without any prelude of warning or even despair, she would see promptly, as if a curtain had been jerked quite unceremoniously away from a little scene, the front porch of the White House, the shady street in front, and the blue automobile in which her husband approached, driving home from work. It was a summer day, a day from the summer before. In the freedom of gaily turning her head, a motion she was now forced by memory to repeat as she hoed the ground, she could see again the tree that was going to fall. There had been no warning. But there was the enormous tree, the fragrant chinaberry tree, suddenly tilting, dark and slow like a cloud, leaning down to her husband. From her place on the front porch, she had spoken in a soft voice to him, never so intimate as at that moment. "You can't be hurt." But the tree had fallen, had struck the car exactly so as to crush him to death. She had waited there on the porch for a time afterward, not moving at all, in a sort of recollection, as if to reach under and bring out from obliteration her protective words and try them once again, so as to change the whole happening. It was accident that was incredible, when her love for her husband was keeping him safe. She continued to hoe the breaking ground, to beat down the juicy weeds. Presently, she became aware that hers was the only motion to continue in the whole slackened place. There was no wind at all now. The cries of the birds had hushed. The sun seemed clamped to the side of the sky. Everything had stopped once again. The stillness had mesmerized the stems of the plants, and all the leaves went suddenly into thickness. The shadow of the pear tree in the center of the garden lay callous on the ground. Across the yard, Jamie knelt, motionless. "Jamie," she called angrily, but her voice hardly carried in the dense garden. She felt all at once terrified, as though her loneliness had been pointed out by some outside force whose finger parted the hedge. She drew her hand for an instant to her breast. An obscure fluttering there frightened her, as though the force babbled to her, "The bird that flies within your heart could not divide this cloudy air." She stared without expression at the garden. She was clinging to the hoe, and she stared across the green leaves toward Jamie. A look of docility in the Negro's back, as he knelt in the plants, began to infuriate her. She started to walk toward him, dragging the hoe vaguely through the flowers behind her. She forced herself to look at him and noticed him closely for the first time, the way he looked like a child. As he turned his head a little to one side and negligently stirred the dirt with his yellow finger, she saw, with a sort of helpless suspicion and hunger, a soft, rather deprecating smile on his face. He was lost in some impossible dream of his own while he was transplanting the little shoots. He was not even whistling. Even that sound was gone. She walked nearer to him. He must have been deaf. Almost stealthily, bearing down upon his laxity and his absorption, as if that glimpse of the side of his face, that turned away smile, were a teasing, innocent, flickering, and beautiful vision, some mirage to her strained and wandering eyes. Yet a feeling of stricture, of a responding hopelessness, almost approaching ferocity, grew with alarming quickness about her. When she was directly behind him, she stood quite still for a moment, in a queer, sheathed manner she had before beginning her gardening in the morning. Then she raised the hoe above her head. The clumsy sleeves both fell back, exposing the thin, unsunburned whiteness of her arms, the shocking fact of their youth. She gripped the handle tightly, tightly, as though convinced that the wood of the handle could feel, and that all her strength could indent its surface with pain. The head of Jamie, bent there below her, seemed witless, terrifying, wonderful, almost inaccessible to her. And yet, in its explicit nearness, meant surely for destruction, with its clustered, hot, woolly hair, its intricate glistening ears, its small brown branching streams of sweat, the bowed head holding so obviously and so deadly its ridiculous dream. Such a head she could strike off intensely. So deeply did she know, from the effect of a man's danger and death, its cause in oblivion. And so helpless was she, too helpless to defy the workings of accident, of life and death, of unaccountability. Life and death, she thought, gripping the heavy hoe. Life and death, which now meant nothing to her, but which she was compelled continually to wield with both her hands, ceaselessly asking, was it not possible to compensate, to punish, to protest? Pale darkness turned for a moment through the sunlight, like a narrow leaf blown through the garden in a wind. In that moment, the rain came. The first drop touched her upraised arm. Small, close sounds and coolness touched her. Sighing, Mrs. Larkin lowered the hoe to the ground and laid it carefully among the growing plants. She stood still where she was, close to Jamie, and listened to the rain falling. It was so gentle. It was so full, the sound of the end of waiting. In the light from the rain, different from sunlight, everything appeared to gleam unreflecting from within itself in its quiet arcade of identity. The green of the small zinnia shoots was very pure, almost burning. One by one, as the rain reached them, all the individual little plants shone out. And then the branching vines. The pear tree gave a rushing noise like the wings of a bird alighting. She could sense behind her, as if a lamp were lighted in the night, the signal light whiteness of the house. Then Jamie, as if in the shock of realizing the rain had come, turned his full face toward her, questions and delight intensifying his smile, gathering up his aroused, stretching body. He stammered some disconnected words, shyly. She did not answer Jamie, or move at all. She would not feel anything now except the rain falling. She listened for its scattered soft drops between Jamie's words, its quiet touching of the spears of the iris leaves, and a clear sound like a bell as it began to fall into a pitcher the cook had set on the doorstep. Finally, Jamie stood there quietly, as if waiting for his money, with his hand trying to brush his confusion away from before his face. The rain fell steadily. A wind of deep, wet fragrance beat against her. Then, as if it had swelled and broken over a daily levee, tenderness tore and spun through her sagging body. It has come, she thought senselessly, her head lifting and her eyes looking without understanding at the sky, which had begun to move, to fold nearer in softening, dissolving clouds. It was almost dark. Soon the loud and gentle night of rain would come. It would pound upon the steep roof of the White House. Within, she would lie in her bed and hear the rain. On and on it would fall, beat and fall. The day's work would be over in the garden. She would lie in bed, her arms tired at her sides, and in motionless peace. Against that which was inexhaustible, there was no defense. Then Mrs. Larkin sank in one motion down into the flowers and lay there, fainting and streaked with rain. Her face was fully upturned, down among the plants, with the hair beaten away from her forehead and her open eyes closing at once when the rain touched them. Slowly her lips began to part. She seemed to move slightly, in the sad adjustment of a sleeper. Jamie ran, jumping and crouching about her, drawing in his breath alternately at the flowers breaking under his feet and at the shapeless, passive figure on the ground. Then he became quiet and stood back at a little distance and looked in awe at the unknowing face, white and rested under its bombardment. He remembered how something had filled him with stillness when he felt her standing there behind him, looking down at him. And he would not have turned around at that moment for anything in the world. He remembered all the while the oblivious crash of the windows next door being shut when the rain started. But now, in this unseen place, it was he who stood looking at poor Mrs. Larkin. He bent down, and in a horrified, piteous, beseeching voice, he began to call her name until she stirred. Ms. Lark! Ms. Lark! Then he jumped nimbly to his feet and ran out of the garden.
Frances Sternhagen reading Eudora Welty's A Curtain of Green. Franny spoke with our producer, Sarah Montague, about this remarkable story from her home in Westchester.
Frances, in a long and distinguished career, you've probably done every sort of theatre. What about reading short stories is different from preparing for a role in the theatre on the stage?
Well, it's different. First of all, you know you don't have to memorize it. That's comforting. But it's also, there's something about reading a story that is different from being a character. And when you're doing a play or something like that, you are just, you're one person, and you don't describe things, you are. It's a kind of different approach. But I must say, I've always loved reading short stories. And, I read to my children, and there's something about reading things aloud that brings them out in a way that just reading them silently doesn't do.
Is it sometimes challenging because the language wasn't specifically designed to be performed? Does that change your approach when you go into a story?
Well, that's possibly true. It's interesting that when I started reading the Eudora Welty story, A Curtain of Green, I didn't know that it was going to have kind of the effect that it seems to have. I don't know why, but it's just there's something kind of magical about the story that maybe doesn't come quite as clear when it's not read aloud. I don't know whether that was partly because I decided to do it with a slightly southern accent, but I really was kind of amazed that there was just not a sound in the audience when I was reading, because when I read it to myself, it didn't affect me the way it did when I was reading it aloud. And I think that must have had somewhat of the same effect on the audience.
Do you think it's partly because the piece is so physical, it seems to be about the heat and the weight, that when you actually read it, you're embodying that a bit?
Yes, that may be true. As you say, there's something about the heat and the dampness and the being surrounded by foliage and also the woman's depression, her working through her pain, all contributes to that.
You've played a lot of very, very strong, determined, foreground sort of women. This woman is all about the inside of her head, and I wondered if that was also finding your way to her was difficult, or how you approached that.
Well, that it was in a way, but in another way, Eudora Welty, in the writing, kind of leads you in. It's quite an amazing little story, I think, because you don't really know when you start reading it where you're going. You don't know that you're going to be affected by what she is affected by. And you find yourself getting immersed in, as you say, and in this dampness, and it's almost as if the foliage is enfolding you. The way it finally, in the story, it does her. She's losing herself in the garden because of her kind of despair at the moment. And I think, strangely, Eudora Welty has presented the character of Mrs. Larkin that way. She doesn't know what's going to happen to her. She just kind of comes out and begins. That's sort of what happens in the story.
What would you say has been the most satisfying thing about your work?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I think, let's say, exploring and revealing changes and hidden things in a character, things that the character has not, doesn't seem to know about either herself or about the situation that she's in before it happens. And it's fun and challenging to explore that and then reveal it to an audience, because that's really what is at the heart of the character.
Well, certainly Curtain of Green delivers that. And
oh, yeah.
Thank you for a lovely reading and for talking about it with
well,
us.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to get the questions.
The actress Frances Sternhagen. We'll be back in a minute with a terrific story by the master storyteller Anton Chekhov. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York. Coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. In addition to being one of the great, if not the greatest, of playwrights in the 20th century, Anton Chekhov, creator of Uncle Vanya, The Three Sisters, and The Cherry Orchard, wrote volume after volume of short stories. We've been sampling these for years on Selected Shorts and have hardly made a dent in the list. We'll now hear a typically heartbreaking and nevertheless funny tale called Concerning Love, translated by Ronald Hingley. I always love the way in which Chekhov, who was also a trained and practicing physician, manages to describe his character's emotional states in terms of their physical symptoms. In this story, for example, he describes the excited fellow as having red ears after listening to Secrets. Concerning Love by Anton Chekhov is read for us by Joe Morton.
For lunch next day, delicious pastries, crayfish, and mutton rissoles were served. During the meal, Nikanor, the cook, came upstairs to ask what the guests wanted for dinner. He was a man of average height, with a puffy face and small eyes, and so clean-shaven that his whiskers seemed to have been plucked out rather than cut off. Alyokin explained that the fair Pelageya was in love with this cook. He was a drunkard and a bit of a hooligan, so she didn't want to marry him, but she didn't mind just living with him. He was very pious, and his religion forbade his just living with her. He insisted on marriage, didn't want her otherwise. He swore at her in his cups, and even beat her. She would hide upstairs, weeping when he was drunk, while Alyokin and his servants stayed at home to protect her if necessary. The conversation turned to love. "What makes people fall in love?" asked Alyokin. "Why couldn't Pelageya love someone else more suited to her intellectually and physically? Why must she love this Nikanor, Fat Face, everyone calls him around here, seeing that personal happiness is an important factor in love? It's all very mysterious. There are any number of possible interpretations. So far, we've only heard one incontrovertible truth about love, the biblical. This is a great mystery. Everything else written and spoken about love has offered no solution, but it's just posed questions which have simply remained unanswered. It seems to explain one instance, but doesn't explain a dozen others. It's best to interpret each instance separately, in my view, without trying to generalize. We must isolate each individual case, as doctors say." "Very true," agreed Birkin. "Your ordinary, decent Russian has a weakness for these unsolved problems. While other peoples romanticize their love, garnishing it with roses and nightingales, we Russians bedizen ours with dubious profundities, and the most tedious available at that. Back in my student days in Moscow, I had a friend, a lovely lady who, when I held her in my arms, was always wondering what monthly allowance I would give her, and what was the price of a pound of beef. We're just the same. When we're in love, we're forever questioning ourselves. Are we being honorable or dishonorable? Wise or stupid? How will it end, this love? And so on. Now, whether this is an attitude that is right or wrong, I don't know, but that it is a nuisance, that it is unsatisfactory and frustrating, that I do know." He seemed to have some story he wanted to tell. People who live alone always do have things on their minds that are keen to talk about. Bachelors deliberately go to the public baths and to restaurants in town just to talk, and they sometimes tell bath attendants or waiters the most fascinating tales. In the country, though, it is their guests to whom they usually unbosom themselves. Gray sky and rain-soaked trees could be seen through the windows. There was nowhere to go in such weather, and nothing to do except swap yarns. "I've been living and farming in Sofina for some time, since I took my degree," Alyokin began. "By upbringing, I'm the armchair type. My leanings are academic. But this estate was badly in debt when I came here, and since it was partly through spending so much on my education that Father had run up those debts, I decided to stay on and work until I paid them off. I made my decision and started working here, not without a certain repugnance, frankly. The land isn't all that productive hereabouts, and if you don't want to farm at a loss, you either have to use hired hands, slave labor practically, or else you have to run the place peasant fashion. Do your own field work, that is, yourself and your family. There is no other way. But I hadn't gone into these subtleties at the time. Not one single plot of earth did I leave in peace. I corralled all the nearby villagers and their women, and I had us all working away like mules. I plowed myself, I sowed, and I reaped myself, bored stiff the while, and frowning fastidiously like a village cat eating gherkins in the vegetable patch because it's starving. My body ached. I was nearly dead on my feet. At first, I thought I could easily combine this drudgery with the cultured life. All I had to do, thought I, was to observe a certain routine. I moved into the best rooms up here. I arranged for coffee and liqueurs to be served after lunch and dinner, and I read the European Herald in bed at night. One day, our priest, Father Ivan, turned up and scoffed my whole stock of liquor at a sitting. The priest also ran off with my European heralds, or rather his daughters did, because I never managed to get as far as my bed in summer, especially during haymaking, but slept in the barn, in a sledge, or in some woodman's hut, hardly conducive to reading that. I gradually moved downstairs. I began having my meals with the servants, and there's nothing left of my former gracious living but these same servants who once worked for my father, whom I haven't had the heart to dismiss. Quite early on, I was elected an honorary justice of the peace and had to go to town now and then to take part in sessions and sit at the assizes, which I found entertaining. When you've been cooped up here for a couple of months, especially in winter, you end up yearning for a black frock coat. Now, at the assizes, you had your frock coats, your uniforms, your tailcoats. They were all lawyers there, all educated men. They were the sort of people you could talk to sit in an armchair wearing clean underwear and light boots with your watch chain on your chest. After sleeping in a sledge and eating with servants, that really was the height of luxury. I was always welcome in town, and I liked meeting new people. Now, among these new friendships, the most serious, and quite honestly, the most pleasant, was with Luganovich, the deputy chairman of Assize. You both know him, a most charming individual. This happened just after the famous arson case. The proceedings had lasted 2 days, we were worn out, and Luganovich looked in my direction. "How about dinner at my place?" I was surprised, barely knowing the man, and then only in an official capacity. I had never visited his home. After calling briefly at my hotel to change, I set off. This dinner led to my first meeting with Luganovich's wife, Anne. She was still very young, not more than 22, and her first child had been born 6 months previously. It all happened so long ago that I'd be hard put to it now to define precisely what it was about her that so much attracted me. But at that dinner, it was abundantly clear. I saw a woman, young, handsome, kind, intellectual, and captivating, unlike any I had ever met before. I at once sensed that this creature was dear to me. I seemed to know her already, rather as if I'd once seen that face, those eager, intelligent eyes, when I was a little boy looking at the album on my mother's chest of drawers. At the arson trial, 4 Jews had been found guilty, and it had been made a conspiracy charge, quite indefensibly, in my view. I became rather agitated at dinner, most distressed, in fact, and I've forgotten what I said now, except that Anne kept shaking her head and telling her husband that, "I just can't believe it, Dmitri. Luganovich is a good fellow, one of those simple-minded chaps who have got it in their heads that the man in the dock is always guilty, and that a sentence may be challenged only in writing through the proper channels, Most certainly not at a private dinner table. You and I didn't start that fire, he said gently, which is why you and I aren't being tried and sent to prison. Husband and wife both pressed food and drink on me. From several details, the way they made coffee together, the way they understood each other almost without words, I concluded that they lived in peace and harmony, that they were pleased to be entertaining a guest. We played piano duets after dinner. Then it grew dark, and I went to my lodgings. This happened in early spring, after which I was stuck in Sofino all summer. I didn't even think of town, I was so busy. But I was haunted all along by the memory of that slender, fair-haired woman. Not directly present in my consciousness, she seemed rather to cast a faint shadow over it. A charity performance was staged in town. I went into the governor's box, having been invited in the interval, and there was Anne Luganovich, seated by the governor's wife. Again, I was struck by that same irresistible, vibrant beauty, by that charming, friendly expression in her eyes. And again, I sensed an intimacy shared. We sat next to each other. We walked in the foyer. And she told me that I had grown thinner. Had I been ill? Yes, I had a bad shoulder and I sleep poorly when it rains. You look worn out. When you came to dinner in the spring, you seemed younger, more sure of yourself. You were quite carried away at the time. You talked a lot. You were quite fascinating. I couldn't help being a bit taken with you, actually. I've often thought of you during the summer for some reason, and when I was getting ready for the theater tonight, I felt sure I should see you. She laughed. But today, you look worn out, she repeated. It makes you seem older. I lunched at the Luganoviches' next day. Afterwards, they drove out to their holiday cottage to put it in shape for the winter. I went with them. I came back to town with them. And at midnight, I had tea with them in the peaceful setting of their home, by a blazing fire with the young mother going out from time to time to see if her little girl was asleep. After that, I always made a point of seeing the Luganoviches when I was in town. We got to know each other, and I used to call unannounced. I was just like one of the family. Who is that? I would hear her ask in the back of the house in the slow drawl, which I found so attractive. It's Mr. Alyokin, the maid or nanny would answer, and Anne would appear looking worried. Why hadn't I been to see them sooner? Had anything happened? Her gaze, the clasp of her fine, delicate hand, the clothes which she wore about the house, the way she did her hair, her voice, her steps, they always made me feel as if something new and out of the ordinary, something significant, had happened to me. We enjoyed long conversations and long silences, each wrapped in his own thoughts. Or she would play the piano for me. When there was no one at home, I would wait, talk to Nanny, play with baby, or lie in the study ottoman reading the newspaper. When Anne came in, I would meet her in the hall and take her shopping off her. I always carried that shopping so fondly and triumphantly, somehow, just like a little boy. It was a bit like the farmer's wife in the story, the one who had no troubles. Not, that is, until she went and bought herself a pig. The Luganoviches had no troubles, so they went and chummed up with me. If I hadn't been to town recently, then I must be ill or something must have happened to me, and both would be genuinely alarmed. What worried them was that I, an educated man who knew foreign languages, didn't devote myself to learning or letters, but lived in the country going round and round the same old treadmill, that I worked so much but was always hard up. I was bound to be unhappy, they felt, and if they saw me talking, laughing, or having a meal, I must be doing so merely to conceal my anguish. Even when I was happy and relaxed, I could feel them viewing me with concern. They were particularly touching when I really was in a bit of a fix, when some creditor was pressing me when I couldn't meet some payment on time. Husband and wife would then whisper together by the window, and he would approach me looking very solemn. "If you're a bit short, Paul, my wife and I would like to lend you something.
Okay.
Please don't hesitate to ask." His ears would flush with embarrassment. Or else he would come up with his red ears after one of those whispering sessions by the window and say that he and his wife do most urgently beg you to accept this gift. He would then present me with some studs, a cigarette case, or a lamp. In return, I would send them something from the country, a bird for the table, butter, flowers. Both of them, incidentally, had money of their own. Now, I was always borrowing in the early days, and I wasn't particularly choosy about it. I took my loans where I could get them. But no power on earth would have induced me to borrow from the Lugano-vitches. Need I say more? I was unhappy. At home, in my fields, and in my barn, my thoughts were of her. I tried to plumb the mystery of a young, handsome, intelligent woman, the wife of an unattractive, almost elderly husband. The man was over 40. And the mother of his children. I also tried to plumb the mystery of this same unattractive husband, this good sort, this easygoing fellow with his boring, commonsensical views, who, when attending a party or a dance, always cultivated the local fuddy-duddies, this listless misfit with his submissive air of being a spectator or a bale of goods put up for auction, of this man who still believed in his right to be happy and to have children by her. Why ever, I kept wondering, had she met him instead of me? To what purpose so drastic an error in our lives? On my visits to town, I could always tell from her eyes that she was expecting me. And she'd admit having had a special feeling all day. She'd guessed I'd be coming. We enjoyed our long conversations and silences, not declaring our love for each other, but concealing it fearfully and jealously. We feared anything which might betray our secret to ourselves. Deep and tender though my love was, I tried to be sensible about it, speculating what the upshot might be if we should lack the strength to fight our passions. It seemed incredible that a love so quiet, so sad as mine, could suddenly and crudely disrupt the happy tenor of her husband's and her children's lives, disrupt an entire household where I was so loved and trusted. Was that the way for a decent man to behave? She would have gone away with me. But where to? Where could I take her? Things would have been different in my life if my life had been romantic and enterprising, if I'd been fighting for my country's freedom, for instance, if I'd been a distinguished scholar, actor, or artist. As it was, I should be conveying her from one humdrum, colorless milieu into another equally humdrum, or even worse. How long would our happiness last? What would happen to her if I became ill or died? What if we just fell out of love? Her reflections were evidently similar. She thought about her husband and children, thought about her mother who loved her husband like a son. If she yielded to her passions, she would either have to lie or tell the truth, but both courses would be equally alarming and difficult to one in her situation. Would her love bring me happiness, she wondered agonizingly? Wouldn't it complicate my life, irksome enough anyway, and beset with all sorts of tribulations? She felt she was too old for me, that she lacked the drive and energy to start a new life. She often told her husband that I ought to marry some decent, intelligent girl who would be a good housewife and helpmeet. But she would add at once that such a paragon was unlikely to be found anywhere in town. Meanwhile, the years were passing. Anne now had two children. Whenever I visited the family, the servants smiled their welcome, the children shouted that Uncle Paul had arrived and clung around my neck, and everyone rejoiced. Not understanding my innermost feelings, they thought I was rejoicing with them. They all saw me as the embodiment of integrity. Adults and children alike, they felt that integrity incarnate was walking about the room, which imparted a special charm to their relations with me, as if my presence made their lives purer and finer. Anne and I used to go to the theater together, always on foot. We would sit beside each other in the stalls, our shoulders touching, and I'd silently take the opera glasses from her, sensing her nearness to me, sensing that she was mine, that we couldn't live without each other. But through some strange lack of rapport, we always said goodbye when we left the theater, and we parted like strangers. People were saying goodness knows what about us in town, but not one word of truth was there in all their gossip. Anne had begun going away to her mother's and sister's more often in recent years. She had become subject to depressions, moods in which she was conscious that her life was unfulfilled and wasted. She didn't want to see her husband and children at such times. She was under treatment for a nervous condition. And still, we did not speak our minds. In company, she would feel curiously exasperated with me. She would disagree with everything I said, and if I became involved in an argument, she would take my opponent's side. If I chanced to drop something, she would coldly offer her congratulations. If I forgot the opera glasses when we went to the theater, she'd tell me that she had known very well I would forget them. Luckily, or unluckily, there is nothing in our lives which doesn't end sooner or later. The time had now come for us to part. Luganovich had been appointed to a judgeship in the West Country. They had to sell their furniture, horses, and cottage. We drove out to the cottage, and as we turned back for one last look at the garden and green roof, everyone was sad. And I knew that it was time for me to take my leave of rather more than a mere cottage. It had been decided that we should see Anne off to the Crimea, where her doctors had advised her to stay, and that Luganovich would take the children to the West a little later. A large crowd of us went to see Anne off. She had already said goodbye to her husband and children, and the train was due to leave at any moment when I dashed into her compartment to put a basket which she had nearly left behind on the luggage rack. It was my turn to say goodbye. Our eyes met there in the compartment, and we could hold back no longer. I put my arms around her. She pressed her face against my breast, and tears flowed, kissing her face, her shoulders, her tear-drenched hands. We were both so unhappy. I declared my love. With a burning pain in my heart, I saw how inessential, how trivial, how illusory it was, everything which had frustrated our love. I saw that if you love, You must base your theory of love on something loftier and more significant than happiness or unhappiness, than sin or virtue, as they are commonly understood. Better otherwise not to theorize at all. I kissed her for the last time. I clasped her hand, and we parted. Forever. The train had already started. I sat down in the next compartment, which was empty. Sat there, weeping until the first stop. Then I walked home to Safino. It had stopped raining while Al-Yokin was telling his story, and the sun had peeped out. Birkin and Ivan Ivanovich went onto the balcony, which had a superb view of the garden and of the river, which now gleamed mirror-like in the sun. As they admired the view, they felt sorry that this man with the kind, intelligent eyes, who had spoken with such sincere feeling, really was going round and round the same old treadmill, doing neither academic work nor anything else capable of making his life more pleasant. And they imagined how stricken that young woman must have looked when he had said goodbye to her in the train, kissing her head and shoulders. Both of them had met her in town. Birkin, indeed, had been a friend of hers and had thought her very good looking. Thank you.
That was Joe Morton reading Anton Chekhov's story Concerning Love. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.